I was very aware of the hot take on it being conservative propaganda. I think the specific phrasing was conservative propaganda for trad wives with a patriarchy king.
We are putting a microscope into women's bookshelves. But women are still people and it can also reinforce patriarchy.
If you've been in a bookstore lately or even just walked by a newsstand or airport book display, you might have seen a sudden increase in a certain type of book. Maybe it has dragons on the cover, or those fancy colored edges, or a portrait of a gorgeous fairy on the cover. That's F-A-E-R-I-E, fairy, if you're spelling it, by the way. Dragons and fairies. You might think these books contain some classic fantasy epic, a la Lord of the Rings. Well, you would be wrong. Books like A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas, or ACOTAR, if you're in the know, are being billed as romanticy, a blend of romance and fantasy. And this new genre is taking the publishing industry by storm. Bloomberg estimates that in 2024, romanticy sales totaled over $600 million, up from about $450 million the year before. It's one of the fastest growing genres of books.
A lot of those readers will talk about it as a space for exploring feelings of feminine rage about a culture that they feel is increasingly turning misogynistic.
But with all of this popularity comes a whole host of questions. Is romanticy just an old-fashioned, reductive romance novel with a few dragons thrown in? Or something more sinister?
Is it reinforcing heteronormative, you know, paradigms if we're going to have these stories where women just keep ending up married to these men?
To sort through these questions, I'm speaking to Netta Baker, advanced instructor in the Department of English at Virginia Tech, and Princess Weeks, online pop culture critic and video essayist. Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. Netta, for those who are new to romanticy, what is it? Give us the elevator pitch.
So a lot of times it gets described in public understanding, like sort of awareness, as just we mashed up romance and fantasy together. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is it's not that, and it's actually just a rebranding of fantasy romance, which is a subgenre of romance. And so in 2015, Bloomsbury, that published Sarah J. Maas, took credit kind of for coining romanticy as a term. And it might have been an attempt to remove some of the stigma that romance as a genre inevitably ends up with. But it had been a term that was floating around.
Okay, so Princess, how did you first encounter this genre, romanticy? What hooked you?
Well, you know, I first started seeing it pop up online, and I was interested because I grew up reading a lot of what we would have called like paranormal fantasy or like paranormal romances, like the Anita Blake books, the Kim Harrison books, these kind of texts that were like female-centered, had like romance subplots, and were kind of treated as like sort of like pulpy, femme-centered fantasy. And so I was excited at this idea of having this mixture of romance-centered fantasy as a genre. And then I was being recommended ACOTAR and Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros, which is this really popular romanticy series about this main character who is forced into this brutal war college for dragon riders, which is a really good premise for a book, I will say. And while they weren't entirely for me, I do think that they spoke to this burgeoning new femme readership online that was looking to have this more adult fantasy stories that had more sexuality and intimacy.
You know, as romanticy becomes more and more popular, people have had more and more to say about it, good and bad, as you both have noted. But there's something people are criticizing it for that I want to dig into with you two. There's a YouTube video, I believe from last year, that has prompted months of discourse among authors, influencers, and fans, making the argument that popular romantasy books are filled with old school trad wifey ideas about relationships. Like in A Court of Thorns and Roses, the main character is powerful, but her male love interest is even more powerful and has to save her a lot. Do these criticisms ring true for you? And are there any examples of this that people are discussing in particular that you've seen?
These are conversations that have plagued the romance genre from the very beginning. This idea of, is it reinforcing heteronormative, you know, paradigms if we're going to have these stories where women just keep end up married to these men? And then you'll have stories where they are, where there are, you know, power structures being reinforced. And that does happen, especially in some of the most popular ones. But then, of course, there are always subversions to those things. But you also have, in my opinion, two different kinds of readership. People who are just, you know, have always loved reading and continue to read. And those who really became readers through the book talk algorithm, and their relationship to reading is a lot more tropified. And so they are reading to get particular tropes out of the stories, and they tend to kind of bristle at more critical discussions of like those power structures.
And like they don't want anyone to perhaps what they might feel is interrupt their fun.
Yeah.
Netta, I want to hear from you on this as well. How are you interpreting these criticisms of romanticism that you've seen? You know, are there any examples of this kind of discussion that you've seen out in the wild?
I was very aware of the hot take on it being conservative propaganda. I think the specific phrasing was conservative propaganda for trad wives with a patriarchy king. You're not looking at the text as, say, a critic experiences it in isolation and thinking about what does it say we should be. And instead, you look at it from the perspective of the communities of readers that build knowledge about what it means to them. So what do they say it does for them? And a lot of those readers will talk about it as a space for exploring feelings of feminine rage about a culture that they feel is increasingly turning misogynistic, more so than ever before. They'll talk about it as giving them representations of male partners that they don't perceive as realistic in real life. And it has nothing to do with the muscles, and the things they talk about instead are, he's supportive. He listens to me. Yeah. He believes me. He is unthreatened by a powerful woman. He accepts me and affirms me. He's emotionally intelligent. And that's what they tend to be receiving from it. And they're very interested in a lot of books that skate under the radar, but are actually highly discussed in more niche spaces, that deal with issues of authoritarian governments, with patriarchal religious control of women, with misogynistic cultures, with economic inequality, with imperialism, and this sort of feminine rage and a heroine who then is able to exert some control over that society, which, given our moment, is something a lot of women feel is not available to them.
There is another like vein of persistent commentary that I want to get into, which is the way that politics are discussed and interpreted within these books. Some of these books, as you mentioned, Netta, present serious challenges to sort of like, you know, fascist governments or, you know, authoritarian rule. But there are also other books that seem to kind of reinforce some of those politics, or at least that's the way that some readers have interpreted them. Talk to me about how the politics show up in these books, or rather how it seems like some of these books or series are imagining or reimagining authoritarian or fascistic or prejudicial like governments.
It's understanding, I forget, theorists who have talked about, you have to accept books on their own internal logic, or you're faced with arguing they should be didactic texts teaching us virtue, which is actually what we kind of were doing in the 18th and 19th centuries, particularly with women, viewing it as, this is how you in a very patriarchal way, deliver goodness and virtue and values. And women or other readers are passive receptors for what authorities have determined should be input, right? Mm,
so that kind of read could be insulting to, you know, a whole lot of women readers.
Yeah, we do have a lot of documentation of the way people worry about women reading romanticy now is an exact mirror of what they worried about women reading romance in the 18th century.
Oh, wow.
And we're saying the same things. It's dangerous to them. It could give them wrong ideas about sex and sexuality. It's potentially hazardous. And in doing that, we both ignore actual psychology of how value systems and doxa are developed, but we also treat women as children, like violent video games. We say women and romance, this is dangerous. It will teach them wrong things and they need to be protected from it. And their reading material needs to reinforce what we deem as correct values.
Princess, I see you nodding a lot. I hear some mm-hmms. Tell me what's on your mind.
I have complicated feelings about that because on the one level, I do agree that we definitely police what women read more so than men. Like we have these kind of discourses about the genres that, you know, especially young women and older women again, all around enjoy. I do, however, as a Black woman do bristle because I will see my white female peers really gleefully sit in racial ignorance of how certain characters are written and presented and how passive imperialism is recontextualized in these texts unintentionally. Like one of the criticisms about ACOTAR is like how it sort of reinforces very passive anti-Irish aesthetic in its text. Someone noticed that the map looks exactly like UK and Ireland and several of the courts that are in the good side are in the UK and the evil ones are in the Ireland section of the map. And like, I don't think anyone believes that to be intentional, but when you are repeating common fantasy tropes without understanding like the racial or sexual context that they existed within, like you accidentally can be, you know, replacing certain things. I think even with monster romances, you know, I enjoy Ice Planet Barbarians. I think it's a very fun series. I definitely enjoy it. I do, however, bristle at how those Ice Barbarians are depicted because they do sort of reinforce this kind of very orientalist sort of like hyper-masculine savage imagery that I feel for like non-white readers, we don't connect the same way that certain white readers might connect those same kind of archetypes. And just a willingness to have that conversation, I think, is what most of us really want. And what ends up happening is this idea that if we bring it out, we are therefore calling readers that enjoy it racist, rather than saying what we are trying to address is the fact that this is something that keeps happening. And I think that's kind of the balancing act that we try to do as feminists who critique or teach is trying to balance the fact that, like, we are putting a microscope into women's bookshelves. But women are still people and it can also reinforce patriarchy.
I think that's an interesting question because it does often come back to reader interpretation and perception, right? I mean, there's readers who don't see the anti-industrialization and environmentalist arguments in Lord of the Rings, but we know they're there because he told us they were, right?
Right, right.
But what I think is interesting is the way fantasy structures more broadly often deal with both a attempt to fight against a dangerous status quo, while at the same time, what they're installing afterwards is something that in our real world, we would still recognize as something very problematic in terms of hierarchies, monarchies, right? To us in a real world scenario, we're supposed to immerse and accept that this is better. Even though if we thought about it, it's like, well, it's kind of just a different name and a different face for a very similar situation, right? Mm-hmm. And I think some readers don't want to negotiate that or critique that. I accept that a lot of people don't find it fun to explore it. I think it's interesting to explore those areas with readers while framing it not as a moral judgment of what they're reading. You enjoying the text doesn't say anything about your virtue, your morality, or your belief that this fits in our real world acceptably. What matters is individual interpretations and then understanding each other's interpretations and validating those, right? Making sure that we're having that conversation instead of saying, no, it's not there, you're wrong, leave my books alone, which is like, well, now we've just shut down like discussions that could be really productive and really interesting about a serious genre. And we make it better by having those in-depth discussions.
I don't know. There still are some veins of criticism of romanticism that kind of hit upon a common theme, as you both have pointed out. You know, the things that young women like, women in general like, are frivolous or escapist or cheap. You know, romanticism often gets described as a way to turn your brain off. Like, how do we critique the books in this genre without falling into the misogynistic tropes that demean what women like?
I think you take it seriously. And I think that there's no reason not to. I think that romance is like, I think seeing yourself be loved is one of the most radical things that can happen to people. And I think that when it's been done by authors of color, queer authors, we see that in action. And also just the possibilities of what it means. And I think that it's a great mirror to yearning and desire and communication. And I think taking it seriously is what matters. And to fight the urge to want to throw an entire blanket over the readership and instead be very clear about the text and the archetypes that it represents that are the issue, not necessarily that some people might have an affection for it. And if you are going to call out that affection, say why. Like, if you're going to call out why that's a problem, be specific.
I love all of that. And also thinking as a public that's not necessarily professional literary critics, I think we tend to fall into this assumption that literary criticism means criticizing, not trying to gain better understanding, and that there's different ways of doing that.
I don't know. You know, you both still read and have enjoyed at least some aspects of these genres. I'm wondering, what are some romanticy novels that maybe you feel like are really doing something really interesting or cool or pushing the boundaries of what romanticy can be? I'd love to hear a title and a short description from each of you if you want to shout one out.
One duology that I really loved was The Divine Rivals by Rebecca Ross. It was in the romanticy section. I don't know if that's really what they would describe it as, but it is sort of like this World War equivalent where these two rival journalists begin to fall in love through exchanging these letters on their enchanted typewriters. But they both go through these amazing character journeys in the middle of a war scene where they both have to challenge, you know, their own expectations for themselves, but also their families. It's also YA. And the way I was kicking my feet when I was reading this book, I was just like, I love this. I love them. I love what they're doing. I thought it was a really amazing blending of like character journey, relationship, rivalry. I thought it was perfect. No notes.
All righty. Okay. I love that. Thank you so much. Annetta, what about you? I'd love to hear a recommendation.
So I go with an indie. A lot of people don't usually know when things were actually self-published first, but Scarlett St. Clair, she's actually a citizen of the Muscogee Nation. Mm-hmm. And she wrote King of Battle and Blood and Queen of Myth and Monsters, which is a duology. And it's about, without giving too much away, it's about sacrifice and rediscovering love that has been torn away. And a lot of dark magic and feminine rage to explore and take back what was lost, and with the love re-emerging alongside it. It's beautiful.
I loved it.
and I loved it.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate this conversation so much. I learned so much about romanticy and its complexities, and I think I'm going to take you each up on your recommendations to start my reading for the year. Princess Netta, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
That was Netta Baker, advanced instructor in the Department of English at Virginia Tech, and Princess Weeks, online pop culture critic and video essayist. And to all of you listening, I want you to know that I see all these sweet messages you've been leaving me. I may be keeping my peace by turning off notifications on my phone, but I want you to know that my whole team and I read every message you leave in the comments and reviews. One of y'all said that you look forward to every episode and literally feel smarter each time you listen. Another said that this show has been a, quote, lighthouse in the storm. Another said that every morning you check to see if there is a new episode of this show. If you relate to any of this, please rate and review the show wherever you're listening. It helps grow our community and is one of the easiest ways for you and me to interact. Thank you for all the sweet notes, and I can't wait to hear from you soon. Love y'all. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Mika Ellison,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patak.
Our supervising producer is
Barton Girdwood.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.